With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hey everybody, welcome to the second drop-in of the season. So happy to have you with us. I'm just back from Birmingham, back in London, and in fact I've just been to the football exhibition at the Design Museum because I think it closes in the next week or so. I'd recommend. Got to start by saying huge thank you for all of the feedback and the lovely messages we've had off the back of our launch episode with Hal Robson-Carnu last week. Our wonderful producer Finn and our genius sound designer Tom Wally and I read everything you sent us, and we really hope you'll keep the messages and questions coming in. These conversations are all about making you smile and hopefully providing some illuminating ideas from the world of football. Now, how about this for a second episode? This really is one of the people I've been hoping to talk with for such a long time. Where you rank him in the best Spurs or England players of all time is up to you. But for me, Glenn Hoddle is one of the very best. We sat down for a cup of tea in a hotel restaurant in Taplow, and Glenn was dressed like a surfer dude in a Nirvana t-shirt. So the whole situation was pretty surreal. As a player for Tottenham, for Monaco and England in the 70s and 80s, his style and his skill marked him out as someone ahead of his time. As a player coach at Swindon and then Chelsea in the 90s, he was said to intimidate some of his players by being still so much better than them. And that was still true, according to Rio Ferdinand, when he took on the biggest job of all after Euro 96 and became England manager. Since he's now a great commentator too, I thought the most interesting thing for us would be to spend time getting his ideas of what makes a truly great player, what makes a great manager, and what he thinks of football today. With that in mind, we kicked off with his reminiscences of the three greatest players he's shared a pitch with. They are some absolute stunners. and they give a real picture of what Glenn values in football and what he valued in his own game. The horrible way things ended at England features in that second question too. I wanted to see how he reflects on those events now and whether, really, he thought he was ready for that huge job at all. It was an unbelievable way to spend an hour, and I really hope you enjoy it. Glenn Hoddle, amazing. Thank you so much for sitting down
Pleasure.
With us. This is so, and I'm glad we got you out of that sweat box. That was ridiculous.
That was a bit too hot up there, would have been.
The plan is, what we wanted to do was, because you were this wonderfully talented player and then you went on to become England manager and then now you're one of the game's most in-demand pundits, we basically wanted to spend our time together thinking about what makes the greatest players and the managers in the game and how that kind of reflects on the choices that you have made in your own life. So the first thing to ask is, what kind of a player did you want to be as a kid, and how far do you feel you got towards becoming that player?
Well, first and foremost, as a kid, you know, it was a love of football that I had within me. So it was almost in my DNA. At a very young age, I mean, I'm thinking back to when I was 6-7 years of age, you know, way back. I slept with a football. I was just crazy about football. Obsessed with football. So where I envisaged where I wanted to go, I think what you do is you wanted to become a footballer, per se, if you got the chance. You never knew at that age, but it was constantly playing football. I had a natural ability. I don't mind saying I was lucky in many ways, but football chose me rather than me choosing football. And I just had this obsession with football as well. So I spent hours and hours and hours playing football from a kid, just non-stop. Left foot, right foot.
Did you think I'm going to be this kind of player? Did you see someone and think, this is what I want to do?
I think the World Cup 66 was, you know, I was 9 years of age and watching England play in the World Cup and winning the World Cup. I think that then I probably looked at Bobby Charlton in that era, in that sort of, although as a youngster, being a Spurs fan, George Best was my favourite player. Because Bestie was Bestie. But I think looking back, Bobby Charlton was the one that probably I played and modelled sort of things and copied things. Went out in the garden after the World Cup and did more of what Bobby Charlton was about, really, than George Best. Although George was my favourite because he was special. Yeah. Bobby Charlton was probably one high up that I emulated a little bit as a kid. He's dropping of his shoulder. I used to go up to the washing line and drop my shoulder on the washing line and things like that. And commentate at the same time. I was commentating even then when I was 7 or 8.
So you put in all the practice for the later career as well?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And do you feel like, because there's a lot of conversation about you, hundreds of people have said, if you're French, if you're Argentine, blah, blah, you'd have had lots more caps. How do you feel like you got to be the player? Do you feel you reached your... the extent of your abilities?
I think it was a hard task in this country compared to what it would have been like if I'd have been abroad. If I'd have been French or Spanish or something, the way they played, the way outlook. Lots of people say that, whether they're Dutch or French themselves or when I went to play in France. Yeah, it was a tough ask for creative footballers back in the day. It really was in the late 70s and 80s. The ball was in the air too much. It was, you know, 60 by 40s really we played in. It wasn't technically, it was more power. It was more strength and power and aerial strength. So it was, you were swimming against the tide, as I like to say it, if you were going to be a creative player. So I got the maximum out I could have got out of myself in English football. But if I'd have been brought up as a young kid coming through different systems, I think I would have been a better player. Yeah.
And what about now? How do you imagine yourself if you were?
Well, now it's changed a little bit. Let's take Foden, for instance, that era.
Yeah.
So what happened back in the day is, you know, we had big pitches. We had the strongest number nine, the biggest centre-back and the big goalkeeper. And they'd whack the ball over the top and the most powerful team would always win the league and that's how they played. And you'd come off the pitch, if you're a midfield player or a skillful player, and you might have had, I don't know, 25 touches of the ball. So suddenly about, 12 years ago, 14 years ago maybe, they started changing things in this country. We followed what other countries had been doing. in making the pitches smaller, making sure that little Johnny, who's got a bit of a creative touch, gets 1,000 touches of the ball every game. So the academy's changed, the school of excellence has changed, the facilities changed, the emphasis, more important, changed on the technical side of the game. Now, you look at Foden when he was 8 or 9, and others with him, I'm just giving him as an example, is why we've now got a batch of English players that have got ability on the ball. So it happened back. You had the ones like myself, and I don't know, you go through. There's not many. They were self-taught, if you know what I mean. We were fighting against the system, you know.
And sometimes undermined as a style. Yeah,
of course. You were called, in England, we had...
You were called Glenda, weren't you?
Yeah, I often think, when I think about it, you know, 26 miles of water saved us in the war. But 26 miles also isolates us from the rest of Europe in many, many ways. And in football, without a doubt, we were insolent. It was a long ball. We had lazy coaching back in the day. We had a director of football at the FA that was a long ball, you know, Hughes was a long ball coach. He wanted everyone to play that way. And we lived through that era, you know, the likes of Chrissy Waddle, Peter Beardsley, you know, some great players. We had Tony Curry before me, Alan Hudson. All these players, they pop up and they come out on their own. They're not because of the system. They fight against it and they come through it because they had the talent. Now the system changes. When I'm saying it changed, what is it, 14 years ago or so, now you're seeing the fruits of Foden. He would have gone to a school of excellence or an academy at 8, and now look at him at 20, what is he, 22. So, you know, probably Mount was the same. You've got Grealish, you've got all these players. So, we eventually changed. So nowadays, it would have been fantastic to play in English football.
Yeah.
With the pitches as they are, the rules as they are, plus the emphasis on what we've done way back. But you know what? I was lucky in the sense I went to Tottenham when I was 11, and Spurs was a technical team. They played technical football. We did a lot of work in the ball court. You know, it was indoors, so it was a lot of technical stuff that we did at Tottenham. Some clubs it might not have been like that, but so I sort of always say, in a way, Tottenham and myself, we did sort of fit like a hand in glove in many ways, as the emphasis that they wanted, the technical side of the game as it was, the push and run side from way back, and then Bill Nicholson. So there was always a way of playing at Tottenham which suited me. Mm-hmm. So I was lucky that it was the
that's
team.
Your club.
Yeah, the team.
And it was your club.
The team that chose me to go there and have a trial, you know, that was a big bonus.
We asked you to think about some of the greatest players you shared a pitch with.
Yeah.
Someone who was a part of a nation that actually did appreciate caressing the ball, treating the ball well, was one of your choices, Johan Cruyff. But is he... I mean, the main story about you guys sharing the pitch is the Feyenoord, when you absolutely destroyed Feyenoord.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at Cruyff as, you know, I shared the pitch with him, obviously, in that game. And I had one of my best games ever for Tottenham. I really did.
Hoddle, so anxious to take over, so keen to eclipse Cruyff tonight. That's a fine ball, and Galvin's through again, and it's 4. After 41 minutes, the Spurs fans see Hoddle lay on another goal. He's had a hand in all 4, and that was a perfect through pass. The man-to-man marking system destroyed, and Tony Galvin going through to finish.
But Cruyff was a special player. It was only the fact that Pelé was around in them days and a few other players, but he was, I think for a short period of time, he was the best in the world. He had problems, not off the pitch in a sense, but they a bit like the Dutch did, and anyway, even their squads, they imploded a little bit. He didn't go to the 74 World Cup, if you remember. No, 78 World Cup. He'd fell out with the Federation, the Dutch Federation. All them things happened. But as a footballer, if you've got a skill named after you, the Cruyff turn, then you've done something great. You deserve to be in my top three.
And you practice that. I remember you saying you practiced it as soon as you saw it. Because one of your best goals is is against Watford. And it's like a more difficult Cruyff turn,
It was a different... Cruyff was in control of the ball, actually. When I did my Watford goal, that ball was travelling towards me. Don't ask me where...
So that makes it harder?
I think it does, actually, yeah. Don't ask me where it come from, because I'd never done it before and it just happened. But no, when Johan Cruyff did it, I can still see the dummy when he went across it. And I think it was against, I can't remember, was it Yugoslavia or Brazil player? Fella in blue. Oh, my word. When he did the turn, I fell off the sofa. And I said to my dad, I remember, I was like, what did he do there? I wanted to, because there wasn't as many replays, and we waited for a replay. And they actually did show the skill. Because it looked like he was going to cross it. The whole stadium and the whole world watching on telly. And suddenly, but the Cruyff skill, you know, isn't that difficult. But it had never been done before. So he's actually then dragged it behind his standing foot and left the fella for dead. He's 4 yards past him. And I just looked at it and I just, after the game, I just went in the back garden and continued to do it, left and right foot. And the dummy of, he was, I mean, the whole world thought he was actually going to cross the ball. And as I say, the actual skill isn't that difficult, but it was the dummy, the body shape and everything. He's crossing that. And certainly the fellow that was marking him thought that as well, because he went out for 3 ice creams and a jock ice. And whew, he was gone.
And that's fantastic. Football as fun as well, in a way, which is something to be really treasured. Speaking of which, another unarguable person that you chose was a certain Argentine.
Oh, Diego, yeah. Well, when I think of Diego, I have to think of the positives, because there's a lot of negatives there. Personally, with the hand of God goal as well as on the pitch, so that hurts.
Does it? It still
hurts. You know what? After the tournament ended, I just felt there was this massive injustice. And... I'm not sure the second goal, which is a wonder goal, probably the best goal ever scored in the World Cup. I'm not sure that goal is scored. You don't know, do you? If the handball one doesn't go in. The emphasis that they had, the confidence that they had then, the game was very tight. And I actually went back and I had to get out of the country. I was going on a holiday a bit late. Excuse me. But I said to the family, no, I've got to, and my mate and his wife, I had to get out of the country. I went to Spain, and we were going to Spain later on, about 3 weeks later, but I needed to watch the final out of the country.
Wow.
And I couldn't sleep for about 3 days. It really, really did affect me, because I just felt the injustice of it. And, you know, can't do anything about it now. I've never blamed Maradona. I blame the officials. You know, the officials, one of them should have picked it up. Well, should have seen it. We saw it. I saw it. But it's a tough one. But in saying that, for me, he was the best player that's hit the planet. Better than Pelé, better than Messi or Ronaldo or anyone else. If these young generation of players, I was talking with some youngsters and I said, look, do me a favour. You all promise, we'll put your hands up. Watch YouTube tonight. Go back and watch Maradona if you haven't watched him. And the response a few days later was incredible. They didn't quite understand how good he was. You just got to watch his free kicks. I think he's got about 53 free kicks where they're just going in left, right and center. He was a genius, the fella. And to play with him in Ozzy's testimonial was wonderful. We had a great time. We couldn't speak to each other, but we had something. There was just this language with the ball, and it was wonderful. And then obviously to play against him in that quarterfinal was amazing. And the goal he scored was incredible, because what people don't realise, the pitch was poor. It was so poor. It really was. There was rats at the bottom of that pitch, and that's why they grew the grass.
Did
so
you say rats?
No, sorry, ruts.
Oh, ruts.
It was rats. Some people might have called him a rat after the goal, yeah.
Rats.
But no, it was ruts. It's my poor English. Ruts.
Not at all.
And that's why they left the grass really long. So to score that goal on a lovely carpet like this is one thing, but to score a goal like that was incredible on that pitch. It really was. That's why it's so special to us, because we knew. You know, people would watch that and say, wow, what a goal, the greatest ever, maybe. But I put it above that, because the pitch was really not great, actually. But to do it on that pitch was amazing. So for me, and I watched him play in Italy. I was in Monaco, so we got the TV right on the border of Monaco and Italy. So I watched him when he was in his pomp for Napoli. I mean, I never seen a team mark any Palais, Cruyff, anyone with two men. Udinese marked him with two guys, followed him everywhere, tried to kick him, could not get close to him. They couldn't get near him. It was just amazing to watch. And this fella was incredible.
That ball was played through to him, but here's Maradona again.
He has Burchaga to his left and Valdano to his left. He won't need any of them. Oh, you have to say that's magnificent. There is no debate about that goal. That was just pure football genius. And the crowd in the Azteca Stadium stand to him. Inside one, away from another, and the coolness under pressure to play the ball home with the side of his foot.
Is it true you sort of nearly might have played with him at Napoli?
Well, I nearly went to Napoli in 80, just after the 82 World Cup, so it wouldn't have been that far. Whether it would have crossed, I'm not sure, because at the time I thought I was going, the president got put in prison, and I think the manager was sent somewhere, and my chances of going suddenly sort of dwindled. And
probably for the best.
For the best, I think. Looking back, I might have missed a little bullet there, but yeah, it would have been great to play with him every week. Yeah, that would have been great. But it was nice with Ozzy's testimonial to play with him. Yeah, it was great, great fun.
You, of course, are so two-footed. I still find it incredible to watch Maradona do everything with one foot.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Messi's really similar, actually. Can you explain
it? Yeah, I think Maradona was even more one-footed than Messi. Messi has his right foot is decent, actually. Everything was with his left side of his body. He was it'd have been some player if he was two-footed, wouldn't he?
Well, exactly right. Do you not? Speaking about you playing that way, that was something that you developed instinctively, or how?
You know what? I didn't develop. I practiced it because I was a nut. I was a football nut. So I spent hour after hour after hour hitting against the wall in my garden and then at Tottenham, where it was left foot, inside the foot, outside the foot, inside, outside. So, but I was doing that when I was five or six. Dad said I was just naturally two-footed. I was very lucky by putting the hard yards as well because I loved the game.
Yeah.
It was a labour of love. It wasn't a chore going out there and practising for hour and hour. It's what I did, scoff me dinner down. Mum would go, but and I would be gone. I was back in the garden or over the park.
You didn't favour either, ever?
No.
As far as you can remember.
It's funny, really. I think if I was taking penalties, I'd take it with my right foot. If I was running with the ball and taking people on, I found more natural with my left foot. But I could hit volleys and score. There's goals with my left foot on my right foot, which is similar. And it's all about the balance, actually. You have to have the same balance on the other side of the foot. If you're using your right, you've got to be totally balanced on your left side of your body and vice versa. And some players, if they're very one-footed, haven't got that. Even when you're coaching, when I had in my academy, I was trying to make them play with it. We had opposite foot day, so they could only use their opposite foot in every session. And they were awkward. And you'd say, well, pretend to hit it with your natural left foot and their right arm would be out. The balance of their right side was all there. And I said, when you do it in the opposite way, and they're going, yeah, my arm's down here. That's how you become. But I was actually lucky that it was just natural.
Yeah.
I didn't have to work at that. It was there, both sides. And I think, getting back to Bobby Charlton did that. I looked at Bobby Charlton and he was left and right foot, naturally left, naturally right, could hit with right, would hit with left, and the opposite side of his body was in perfect position.
You've talked about, what have you said, something like you scored great goals, but you weren't a great goal scorer.
Well, no.
Do you mean
goals,
that?
No, but a great goal scorer, I mean, is like a Michael Owen, he's a Robbie Fowler or a Jimmy Greaves.
Or the guy we're about to talk about? George Weah.
Oh, George.
Yes.
Yeah, George.
He was your third pick, wasn't he?
Yeah, I played with him at Monaco. George was he's a wonderful guy, you know, a great human being. But I've got to tell you the story of when I first saw George or met George. So I'm playing for Monaco, me and Mark Hatley. We go up to La Turbie, which is a great training ground up in the mountains.
Oh, wow, by the way.
Yeah. It is a wow factor.
Look it up. Look it up, guys, if you haven't already seen it. It's like into the rock.
It's in the rocks, and it's looking over the south of France. You know, it was really hard to play out there. No, it's a wonderful sight, a wonderful spot. Anyway, so we go up one, it was, I think it was February, it was quite wintry. Anyway, we go up and we go in, walk through the door into the changing rooms, and Arsene Wenger was manager. And there was a guy there in a long robe and pair of sandals on.
Mm.
And he had a brown paper bag under his arm, tall, really built, good presence about him, shoulders, just this robe, and it was like, and a brown paper bag under his arm. And we went, bonjour, shook hands, walked past him thinking, dunno, it was a fan, was
it? Dignitary of some kind.
Yeah. No idea.
Yeah.
Anyway, 5 minutes later, Arsene brings him in. He says, look, this is George. He's on trial for 2 weeks. He's from Liberia. Speaks English. Put him in between you and Mark. So we say, hey, George, you know, and he took the robe off, and he got the brown paper bag, and he unfolded them, and he had these boots, and they had holes in. It was his football boots,
yeah.
And they were old, and there was little holes in them and everything. And I was like, wow. So puts it on, puts the kit on. Cool, he looked apart. As soon as he put the training kit on, you think, I said, what position do you play? I play up front. So I thought, oh, okay. So we go out, and we're first team versus the reserves. So Mark Akeley's up front for the first team. We're playing, and poor old George, for 10 minutes, we're too good for the reserves at the day. It was a strong team we had. So George couldn't get a kick. I was thinking, God, poor lad, he can't get a kick. Arsene should have put him in our team, and we could see, you know, if he's on trial. Anyway, he drifts out to the right wing. He gets the ball. Somebody gives him the ball at the right wing, and we had a great left-back, Amoros, and played national team about 90 times. Anyway, he put this dummy on. He went as if he was going to hit it down the line, and he'd come inside, left Amoros on his backside. He dropped his shoulder on Battiston. Battiston was playing for us. He drops his shoulder, goes past Battiston, beats two other players, hits this shot, and Jean-Luc Ekeri, who was the goalkeeper, who was a national goalkeeper, gets nowhere near it, and it smashes against the bar and flies out the other side for a throw-in. And the whole, we all went, wow. And Arsene started laughing. And I remember saying to Mark Akeley, Mark, you better get your finger out, mate. You've got a bit of a challenge here. And then George didn't touch the ball for another 10 minutes. And then when he got it the next time, he dropped his shoulder. He went past two or three players. I thought, why? I said, Arsene, where have you got him from? He said, he's a natural talent, Glenn. And in the end, he got in the first team. Mark got injured. He got in the first team. And he was just, he was fantastic. He had no idea what the game was about. He said to me, he said, what happens if you get injured, Glenn? He said, I'm finished. I said, what do you mean, George? I said, you're the most natural player. You're fantastic, mate. He said, no, I don't know. You tell me where to go when we defend.
Oh, I see.
And all that. So I used to talk to him and say to him, not yet, George, don't press yet. I'm not, you know, blah, blah. Now go, go, go. And he used to love that. And he said, but without you, if you're injured, what do I do? He said to the coaches this.
So you were coaching.
I was coaching.
You were coaching even at that time when you were playing at Monaco.
I said to Arsene, look, he said he's raw. I said, but what a talent. And when he had the ball, he just did what he did. And Arsene said, look, you need to perhaps guide him a bit. I said, yeah. And so it was literally when we're going to press together. And he'd go to go. I go, no, George, not yet. We're not ready to go yet. Save your energy. And he'd go, okay. So it was literally like that for the first season when he was at Monaco. But my word, is some of the goals he scored and some of the
That's
tricks.
So
and
cool.
The skill,
something else to look up.
The
oh, my God.
Skills that he did. It was lovely. It was fantastic. And, you know, this is what football does. And this is the romantic side of football. Is that from that brown paper bag and unrolled in that, you know, and seeing them boots, he goes on to become World Player of the Year later on in his future when he went to AC Milan. And that's what football can do. And he's become president of his country. Yeah, I did catch up with him a few years back and we had a real laugh and a real cuddle, and it didn't seem as if he'd changed that much to me, you know. But I asked him if he still had his boots.
Petit. Avec Djorkaeff. Djorkaeff qui a vu Georges Weah. Frappe de Weah, croisé, but. But de Georges Weah après 21 minutes. En première période, Arsène Wenger est ravi. Il fallait ce but pour débloquer les Monégas.
Is that when you started to think that you were a person who might manage, who might steer other players? Was it there at Monaco?
It was in Monaco, but it wasn't then, actually, funny enough. I was just doing what was needed for the player and for the team. I was an experienced player at the time. I was, 29, and so I understood the game. It was in Monaco, but not perhaps that season when George came in. It was the one where I had my injury, and I was out for about 8 months, and I was looking at the game different because I knew I was struggling to play again. And I just started to look at the game differently, like through a coach's eyes, and what the opponents were doing and what we were doing and what I would do maybe different, or not different, but I would, you know, and I'd started to look through a different set of curtains, as I call it. And then it was at Arsene, actually, one day said, you know, this was before I had the injury. He said it way before, obviously, when I was talking probably about George at the time. And he went, you know, Glenn, he said, have you thought about going into coaching after? I said, no, never. I didn't see myself as that. I was too concentrated on playing and extending my career as long as I could, you know. But obviously the injury, I still managed to play at Swindon and Chelsea, funny enough, but I was hobbling around on one knee, really, in that stage. But
I mean, okay. Would we call it that? I mean, a lot of players who've played with you as player manager have said that they found it pretty intimidating, better you were.
I can assure you, it felt I only had one knee hobbling around on it because it was a lot of pain. I've still got pain now playing golf with it. But no, it was then that I thought, oh, you know what? Arsene might be. And I started to look differently and thought, yeah, I'll go back to England and I'll see if I can get fit. If I can't get fit, you don't know where's your next step going to be and go into coaching. So it could have been at youth level. It could have been anything. I had an open page, and it was when I was trying to get back fit that Swindon come knocking, and I decided to go there.
And what it meant ultimately was that when you took the England job, you were still 38 years old?
39, I think. 39, touching 40, yeah.
I just finished 40, come on. Yeah. That's still extremely young. That's still extremely young to be managing England.
Of course.
Did you feel like... Yeah. What do you make of the fact that you were appointed at that young age?
I was a bit surprised that they'd come for me at that age, but I have had no qualms at all about taking the England job because of my age. And I think the proof in that is the percentage. My winning percentage was 61. I mean, if it was like a disaster on the results and that, I'd have thought, well, I wasn't ready.
Yeah, you're up there with lots of others.
I wasn't ready, yeah. You know, I shouldn't have took it. I never, ever have I thought that, and I didn't certainly feel that when the opportunity came. But on the other side of with the England job, probably I wasn't ready. You know, the with the press and dealing with all the other things. The football side, the you know, coaching of the players, trying to go into a World Cup, planning the team, the coaching, the training, everything about that, I felt capable and not too young. The other side, I think, looking back, maybe it would have, if I'd have had it 12 years later, 10 years later, I could have actually dealt with that much, much better and easier, going into stuff and doing stuff. And, you know, that was the bit that was always going to be a slight problem for every England manager. And maybe that's where I was inexperienced on that. I hadn't quite had enough of that side of the job. But on the football side, I was very confident that we could do it.
Sounds like you're referring to what happened when you finally had to leave the job.
So not so much that. Even before, in the press conferences, they weren't that important to me. I didn't really enjoy them. And realistically, I should have. If I was more experienced, if I had got the job tomorrow, I'd be more experienced. I would actually spend a lot of time doing more stuff that I didn't do. I didn't really like, you know, that was a pain in the backside part of the job. Yeah. It was like, oh, I've got to do it. But, you know, and I think that came across a bit like that. I wanted to be out there with the training pitch with the boys, you know, and I wanted to be the coaching, I wanted to plan the team, and that was real. The real job for me, the real job was that. Not, but nowadays it's, and I think maybe later on, maybe 5 or 6 years after, I would have looked at it different and thought that's just as important as that. The two go hand in hand. Whereas maybe naively, or maybe because I was inexperienced, I was just I had my football head on. I loved football. I'd only just finished playing. It was football, football, football. It was the team. It was this. It was scouting. It was the shape of the team. It was everything football. Oh, I've got to do a press thing. Oh, that's a pain. I didn't prepare for them. I went in and I said to David, you know, David Davis and people like that. I said, well, what's the SP? What's going on? And then they go, well, this. I go, okay, right. And, you know, you get all these questions, and I go, oh, let's get it out of here. Let's get out of here as soon as I can, sort of thing. And I think they knew that, and it come across like that. I didn't mean it in an arrogant way. It was just, this isn't the job that I really want. I like to be out there doing the football side.
So you're almost too much a footballer still, yeah, when you were trying to do this job?
Possibly, yeah. Probably you still had a football head on, and the love of the game was more important than all the other stuff that had to come with that job. We're a bit more experienced, a bit more, you know...
Nouse, even.
Yeah, nouse, and a bit of understanding that, you know what, there's a balance to this job that you've got to do. And I think, you know what, I think Gareth's done brilliant. Gareth bringing it up to date now, he's done, and managers since then have dealt with certainly the both sides, the balance of the job, very well, very well.
I mean, I suppose one of the things that connects into that then, we asked our listeners for a few questions, and just, you know, what rafts of questions came in. Of course, we haven't got lots of time, but many people asked about the experience of telling Gazza he wasn't in the 98 squad. That was what people are fascinated by. And I wonder...
I thought it was going to be Diamond Lights.
Don't worry. That's the next one.
I was pretty sure you were going to say Diamond Lights.
I think probably that appeared more than that one, but only just. I wonder if that's... Gazza, as we know, is clearly... troubled character, someone who was volatile. But do you feel, looking back on it now, like you could have handled it in any better way?
No.
To have a different outcome?
No, there wasn't a different outcome. This is what people didn't want to hear at the time. And this is where the press, you know, the perception of it makes better for reading than the real truth. Gazza didn't go to the World Cup simply 100% that he wasn't fit. He had a knee problem and a calf problem, which I'd known. Tried to get him fit since we qualified in Rome. Told him he had to get fitter and all them thing. Anyway, lots of chats with him about that. Didn't take that heed. But I thought, well, he still can get through with this knee and this calf problem. I said, but he needs to show me he's fit. And I left him to the last game because there was all this stuff going on in his life. Other stuff, and which wasn't great, and I thought, oh dear, you know, I'm gonna have to oversee that. He's played really well for me in the qualifiers, and he's been in the same sort of similar shape, so I'm gonna have to oversee that. So in the end, it was about getting through the last game against Morocco, and he gets a hematoma, and the physio said to me he's gonna be out at least 3 weeks, what with his knee and his calf. So I had to make a call on that. That was the only honest reason why Gazza didn't go. He played in all my qualifying games. He was doing great for me. So yeah. I wanted him there. But I was gutted that Gazza without playing for 3 and a bit weeks. And if we'd have gone all the way, it would have been probably semi-final. I'm probably not going to change the team anyway. Gazza not being, you know, back Gazza being Gazza, probably I couldn't see him for 3 weeks heeding and doing what he would need to do to get himself absolutely fit.
Yeah.
And it was the saddest decision I've had to make. Not the toughest. The toughest was easily the Swindon when I first took over, letting apprentices know that they weren't going to be taken on as pros and then breaking down in the office and crying. And, you know, you're telling them virtually that you don't think they've got a career in football. That was the toughest thing I've ever done. So the Gazza one was the saddest. But it was, you know, and also people forget because it was Gazza, obviously. But I had 7 other players that I had to tell as well that they weren't going, so I had to be as straight with them as I was with Gazza. And you know, but Gazza had some ghosts. He had some problems at that time. It was all sorts of stuff. But if he'd have got through that game against Morocco, he would have gone. He'd have gone.
So it's not so much about the decision then that's interesting to me. Mm. I wonder, do you feel like the conversation you had with him was the best you could have... Do you think with more experience you could have handled it any differently, specifically interpersonally with him as a manager?
Yeah, but you know what? I did it with every player. I spoke to them. I had them into the room and I spoke to them. Some managers have done it on text, you know.
Yeah, well...
So
you feel
know,
like you did everything you could and his reaction
I looked at it... You know where I looked at it? I looked at it... If it was me as a player, how would I want to be told?
Yeah.
And I would want the manager to sit me down and just say, look, this is the reasons why. Bang, bang, bang. I wouldn't be happy. I'd be sad. I'd be frustrated, blah, blah, blah. But And I had to go through that a little bit. And it was over the phone with Bobby Robson myself, you know, when I didn't go in 90. So I needed, you know, we're all in the same vicinity. We took all the players there and I was going to cut them down. So every player, all eight of them did that. There were seven others that came in and spoke and I gave them the reasons. So I don't think I could have done it any better. And you know, to say that he smashed the room up is just not true. He smashed his hand into the door and dented the door. He must have broke his wrist, I think.
And that was all he
did.
God,
that's all he did. That's all he did. But, you know, the press said he smashed the room up and did this and did that.
Have you ever broken any limbs out of frustration? I don't think that's a very normal thing to do, is it? Oh, God.
Yeah.
Are you a crier, Glenn? Did you ever find yourself getting emotional in those situations?
Well,
when you were having to deliver this news or when end of it?
No. You're a professional. I can cry over a film if it's an emotional film. You watch The Champ. Have you ever watched The Champ? I'll watch it. You've got to go and watch it.
Oh, no, I can't. I would cry at everything.
You'd definitely cry at that film, The Champ. John Voight. Brilliant film. Anyway, I digress. No, you put a professional head on. It's you're doing a job.
So was your highlight, is your finest moment then it, as England manager, was it that qualifying game, the 0-0 against Italy, and you're playing the three at the back, and did you feel like we've cracked this? We've cracked it.
I guess that was, yeah, looking back, that was a Titanic performance.
It was so un-English, is what you think.
And I remember Zola, Gianfranco, saying something, which was, you know, sometimes you hear things from your side of the fence and whatever. It's easy for a player or a coach or whatever. Pundits at the time saying great performances and that, but Gianfranco said to one of the players, not to me, but I think he said, I've never seen an England team play like that, and that was music to my ears, to be honest. And we played some great stuff, and the Argentinian game was the most emotional game. I mean, that was I've never had a roller coaster like that in my life. But I think as a performance,
so this is the knockout at the World, where we were knocked out on penalties.
Michael scores the one
at the 98 World Cup.
Yeah. Michael scores the wonder goal, announces himself.
Michael the child,
babyface assassin. And what a goal. And then, you know, the ups and downs of that game, to think we thought, you know, it was golden.
75 minutes nearly, wasn't it, with 10 minutes?
We had a golden goal as well, if you remember.
Oh, my goodness.
And Sol scored, so we're thinking we're...
Well, I do remember, but our producer wasn't alive for that game.
Oh, right.
So, you know, that's good, just as a bit of context for the listener.
Ouch. Makes me feel really old.
Really broke my heart when I realised that. But yeah, so sorry, it was golden goal.
Well, it broke my heart as well when I realised it was disallowed. I've got to say, I was in the same group with you. No, the ups and downs of that game was the most emotional I've ever experienced, you know. But I think the best performance was Rome. Yeah, to go there as well. They tried to keep it quiet from the boys, which was impossible. The 17 matches they hadn't been beaten there in that stadium. You know, it was like, it really was. It was gladiator. It was, we were going into the den, and 90,000 Italians, you know, baying for blood.
Another look at the watch from the Dutch referee. Wright chases. Peruzzi hesitates, and Ian Wright goes on. It's still Wright. Can he score? He's at the post. This is Sheringham.
Oh dear.
Well, the game isn't over. It effectively could have been. And here come Chiesa and Italy with Del Piero. Oh!
Well, you won't get good chances.
The drama of top-level sport encapsulated in those last seconds.
And to think, as a manager, that was like, you know, I just had a moment. I remember in the tunnel, having that moment and just visualising the country back home, you know, just visualising the pubs and the clubs and the people, just thinking, wow, we've done it, you know. And I've been like that as a supporter.
Yeah.
So it was great. It was great to have that feeling. Yeah.
That's a beautiful thing to have created for your country that you were so proud of.
Yeah, well, I was a part of it. You know, the players are the ones that go out and implement it, but... No, it was a special night, yeah.
Another key thing to ask about in terms of, like, your reflections on it today is how it ended with England. So you resigned after making comments about disability and reincarnation. How do you reflect on that now? How that played out and all of the
problem is, people still, you know, and I've it's, it, it's there for me to put you in a way right. It wasn't your fault. A lot of people think that. I did not say that about it. That's not my beliefs about the disabled people. That's never been my belief. I do believe in reincarnation. I said that before I went to the World Cup. There was no problems. I think more than half the world believe in reincarnation. But it's nothing to do with all the stuff that was written. That wasn't me. That wasn't quotes from me. That's not my belief, and I've said that in my book. And how that got spun, that's just one of them things. That's what happens in life. I can assure you that is not my belief, and never will be, and never was. So you get an opportunity to come back. You come back to learn. So there, that's completely different than saying someone gets punished if you're disabled. That's just not true. It's not a punishment. It's reincarnation's a lifetime of experience, really, in many ways, to understand it. So I wasn't, I was frustrated that I lost the job.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
People do want to ask about Diamond Lights.
I thought it might be the clock.
Adam on Instagram just says, and I think he speaks for all of us when he says, "I just want to know everything about the recording process of Diamond Lights," which was, I don't know. Would you want people to look it up if they haven't heard it? Your performance on Top of the Pops, or would you prefer the music video?
Well, the video, Top of the Pops, it doesn't matter, does it? Either way. Or a clock, even. Grandfather clock. No.
Is that Mars Singer you're
about?
Yeah,
that was. I just love my
music.
You're
a performer, aren't you, though?
No, honestly, I just always love music. Second to football was music. I just loved singing as a kid. All the time, I have music. We didn't plan to do Diamond Lights.
Right.
Absolute not. Me and Chrissy, we like our music, but there was a mate that... It's a long story, actually. But in the end, he kept pestering us to do this song because he heard us get up and sing at some sponsored do that we did. But
you were getting up and just singing at
random... No, they got us up. They got me and Chrissy up on the band, and we sort of done
it. How much pestering is needed in order to require you to ask you to sing on, for example, a podcast called The Football Ramble? Is that
longer than 3 months?
Oh, what?
No, three. It was Yeah, and he pestered the life out of us, and he said, I've got a friend who writes songs and this and that. We said, we don't want to do a song. We don't want to do a song. Anyway.
What did then Chris want to do?
Loads of days and months go by, and in the end, we end up deciding to meet the guy, Bob Pusey, lovely guy, and in the end, we got our arms twisted to do this song. It was a real slow ballad at the first, and we went, we're not doing that. So he quickened it up for us, and in the end, we end up on bloody live Top of the Pops.
I can't believe
that's the scariest thing I've done.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, the grandfather clock was hard and scary because it was so claustrophobic singing live and in that sort of, in a box, really, over your head. That was hard. But no, to think, when they said you're going on live Top of the Pops, we nearly...
That was a massive show as well back then, right? Yeah.
That was...
Appointment,
and it actually was live. You know, sometimes they recorded it. But this one was going to be live. But they all mimed. You didn't have to sing it live, even. And we followed a team. We followed a group called Five Star. You too young for Five Star.
No idea. Five Star.
Five Star. There was five in the group, and they
forerunners of five.
They were absolutely. They danced and sung, and they were perfect. You know what I mean? They're all in sync, all like a little bit like Michael Jackson doing all this, and that. And we had to follow them.
In your jackets, looking like Miami Vice.
Absolutely. Miami Vice. I had my white jacket on. I think I had the sleeves rolled up, like Don Johnson. And but you couldn't see... I'm glad you couldn't see what was going on inside.
You looked like you were enjoying it. Were you enjoying it a bit, weren't you?
I tell you what, I hated it up until it started. When the music... We had to go for it. I said to Chris, we're going to...
Chris didn't go for it, I'm sorry.
He was petrified when he... clinging onto that stand. But we had a right few... We had to have a few beers, you know, in the afternoon. We'd been training and the car picked us up and we... I said to the fellow, go and get a case of beer. I said, we're gonna make ourselves look absolutely, even more ridiculous than we looked. And we had half a case of beer before we went on to get out there just to, you know, do it. So.
So you were loose.
We were loose-ish. We were very loose in Langens after when we went afterwards with the girls. That was good.
But, so sadly, the career as a pop star didn't really take off.
Well, it could have done, but I.
You said,
it took a long time for us to come round. You know, I've done quite a few songs, funny enough. What with the Tottenham FA Cup songs and the England World Cup songs, I think I've been in the top 12 six times.
Bloody hell.
There you go. Now, the quality of the songs, I'm not so sure about it. Other people judge that, but I can wear the T-shirt, can't I?
Nirvana. In fact, guys, he is wearing a Nirvana T-shirt right now in this interview, which I think...
Honest, I've never seen them.
It's all right.
It's just I like the T-shirt before I went on holiday. Is that all right?
Yeah, you can pull it
off.
Anyway.
I'm an Eagles man.
Right. You look incredibly brown as well, so you can pull off the kind of surfer boy look, which I think is what you're going for.
Yeah.
Is it too late
to surf at 64?
No, it's never too late. I actually think... I don't know about hips and stuff, but I think that would really suit you.
No, I'm not sure. Not sure about that one.
You spend your time... I mean, well, now you spend your time basically working fairly regularly as a pundit, as a commentator as well.
Yeah.
It seems like you really enjoy it, and it seems as though you... like you said earlier, you know, watching this game of football that's developed on so much from what it was when you were playing.
Of course, does that
hurt a bit? You?
No, not at all. I like the way that football and all sports. Let's face it, you've only got to look at all the sports, and you've got to look at the women football, the women cricketers, the golfers. Every sport's come on. The golfers now—they hit the ball miles. You know, cricket is amazing. The one-day game is what it's done for cricket. And football's the same. The lighter balls, the pitches, the rules of the game is all about now. It's completely turned the other way. It's all about creative football.
Yeah.
Scoring more goals, creating more. So, you know, every sport has evolved like that and become better and better. Not every sport, but most sports have.
Do you think that's true, given the situation with Man City and this kind of what many people think of as being kind of clinical, everyone working in their own, knowing their jobs and playing as this like slick unit that maybe doesn't allow that much space for expression. Do you value that?
No, I disagree with that to a certain degree, because Man City could never do what they're doing on the pitches we used to play on. They just couldn't.
No.
You couldn't pass out from the goalkeeper like that into the, in your own penalty area and play out with the divots and the hard, and the dust when it's in April. So that the pitch is now dictated to people playing out from the back more. You know, and I think sometimes we're guilty of overplaying. In actual fact, probably Man City are the only ones that can do it all the time and do it when they want to do it. Others are guilty of it because everyone's got to be 100% in sync with that and happy with that. Even you go to watch the League One teams and stuff, they're all trying to play out from the back at times, and I'm hiding behind the sofa some of the times when I'm watching the game. But it's nice, it's technical, it's about playing through the pitch. I would love to have played in this era.
Yeah.
With the rules as they are and the pitches and the way the game's spaced out. We played in 60 by 40 box. Yeah, yeah. And that ball would drop down from a goal kick, and like, good luck if you could show a bit of skill and beat someone and get a ball through to a striker. You've done well, and that's how we played, you know?
Do you think, you know, how they've been making advances on not letting kids head the ball, do you think that's likely to fade out of the game?
No, it shouldn't be. It should never be shaded. No, it should never go out. If they want to do that, you know, it becomes like the five-a-side. You know, ball can't go over your overhead height. That's ridiculous, you know. Use a sponge ball. They can heading's not just about the actual physical heading. Yes, of course, if they were heavier balls in the 60s and the 70s, the balls are lighter now. It's the training time. It's spending 30 headers and getting your timing right and getting your arms in the right position. Now, if kids are not going to do that, use a sponge ball. It's not going to take anything away. They're still doing the timing. They're still jumping. They're still getting the head and their neck through the ball, but they're not getting the blow on the use sponge balls.
Right.
Make sure you serve.
Which is the concern, of course. It's about the head potential for head injuries. Yeah.
When they're older, you can, you know, you that becomes different. Football has got to have heading in there.
Last two things before we wrap. Do you think Spurs can win the league this season?
Sometime in the future. Yeah.
Oh,
of course.
No. What?
Can they win the league this season? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think they can win it
because I don't think Chelsea can win it. I don't think Tottenham can win it. Arsenal, all them teams below Liverpool and Man City. I still think it's a two-horse race to come to winning the title. I think there might be a spell when some of these clubs might actually have a little spell at the top, maybe for a little spell. But I think Tottenham are going to have a better season than they've had for a long time. Yeah, I think they're going to go toe-to-toe with anyone. You can beat, they beat Man City twice last year, so you can go toe-to-toe, but I mean really go toe-to-toe, physically, technically, tactically. Conte's the right man, he's a winner, he's bought very shrewdly. Yes, I think they're going to be a force this year, and I think they could probably, you know, get Champions League again. It would be nice if a bit of silverware come their way as well, but I think it would be domestic. But that group of players could do something special in the next two or three seasons. That's if Antonio feels he wants to stay and do a project. He doesn't really do that, does he? Maybe, just maybe, with that beautiful stadium, that beautiful training ground, with a group of players he's got at the moment, and you've got to say, I think he's bought shrewdly, and he's added to that squad.
Yeah.
He might just look at that and go, I like it here. And it would be nice if he stayed for two or three seasons to see it right out, you know. Only he knows that.
Yeah, well, and there's a lot of backwards and forwards, isn't there, of course, playing the game, doing the conversations that you didn't so much enjoy. And just before we go, of course, lots of, you know, people watched on in like horror and terror in 2018 when you had that terrible, in fact, one of the women on the Ramble, Jules Breach, was in fact in the studio.
She was, bless her.
So, yeah, we just... How are you doing now?
I'm doing fine.
I'm doing very good.
I'm not sure about the surfing, but no, I'm just so fortunate. I'm so lucky to be here. You know, Simon Daniel saved my life. The sound engineer and you know, a lot of people have a cardiac arrest and they've got 3 minutes. Basically, you've got 3 minutes, and some people in life. They're not in the environment where someone can save their life with a CPR, which is so important. So I was saved completely. I knew nothing about it. 1 minute I'm at BT keeping the ball up with Robbie Savage, and then next minute I woke up in a hospital. So I, you know, all the trauma and everything my family went through and the people in the studio went through. I know, you know, Jules was there. I think Pooks was there. Incy and Sid. Robbie, obviously, and I think it affected them quite a bit. You know, I would have hated to have seen it myself with somebody else. I think Harry was there as well, Harry Redknapp. So yeah, that was, they went through the trauma, but I woke up in the hospital and I was just, you know, when it was all said to me after, I was just so thankful. I mean, just so grateful. Has it changed my life? Of course it has, yeah. I mean, I've always believed in the afterlife, but now it's just, oh dear, you know, life is really unfolding in such different ways. It's so important, you know, every second. And you know what, I came out and said this afterwards, and I really truly believe it. And this made it, what happened to me, I didn't see a light, I didn't go to the light like some people did, but there has been a change within me. But I think it's, you know, it's not what we achieve on this planet, it's how we achieve it is more important. That's what you can take with you. That's really important to me and important to my kids and my grandchildren now, you know, yeah, nice to be here.
Oh, well, Glenn Hoddle, thank you so much for spending some of that time with us on
Pleasure.
The drop-in.
Enjoyed it. Really thank good you. Fun.
That's it then, guys. Our second drop-in with Glenn Hoddle. Oh, I really hope you enjoyed it. Would love to hear what you thought at Football Ramble or at KVL Mason on Twitter. It's such a bizarre thing, sitting down with someone you've dreamed of talking to. You want to make sure you ask him all the things you and also everyone else who knows you're talking to him has wondered about. He's a touchstone for so much of football history that I wasn't even alive for. It almost has the quality of myths hearing him talk about playing against Diego Maradona. It was important to get Glenn's reflections on those comments he made before losing the England job. To be honest, it sometimes becomes pretty clear pretty quickly that an interviewee doesn't want to talk about something in detail, and the record on what was said all those years ago seems to be pretty clear, so I didn't push him on it. Get in touch with your questions on Twitter at Football Ramble and tell us who else we should chat with. We've had some great suggestions already. We're digging into some of them right now. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at KVL Mason, and I'll speak to you very soon.
The Football Ramble is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
And now you're going to sing us the outro.
Always look.
Yes, come on.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. Why When Question Time is a Stack production.